Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Deborah Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for mid-September. This week, we are very pleased to have for you part one of an interview that we recorded a couple of weeks ago with Lucas Hart, the director of the Northwest Straits Commission, focusing on forage fish. But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. All I can tell you about this sound is that you will never guess what it is, and when you find out what it is, it will make you laugh. A big hint for it is that it is connected to our main topic for this week. We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is. Bruce Labar, posting last week on Tweeters, the University of Washington's birding site, reminded us of all the wonderful sights to be seen when boating off the coast of Westport, in the far southwest corner of the Olympic Peninsula. As they motored farther out from shore, the highlights were seeing 26 black-footed albatross, 6 northern fulmars, 186 pink-footed shearwaters, 12 bullers, 127 sooty shearwaters, and 2 short-tailed shearwaters, and 4 fork-tailed storm petrels. Fishing boats are obviously a huge attraction for seabirds because of bycatch. During this time, they also saw their first South Polar Skua, 2 Pomerine, and 1 Parasitic Jaeger, along with 2 Tufted Puffin. The beginning of large numbers of Sabine's Gulls, 211, and Cassin's Auklets, 51, were also in this area.
In the deeper waters, the Cassin's Auklets seem to be everywhere, with 1,100 recorded, and Sabine's Gulls continued to be plentiful, with another 121 seen. Then they started seeing many splashes in the distance, and within a few minutes, they were surrounded by 100 Rizzo's dolphins, 60 Pacific white-sided dolphins, and 3 northern right whale dolphins. Other highlights throughout the day include 9 humpback whales, 1 that breached, and 2 Doll's porpoises.
Speaking of whales, the New Scientist magazine recently published some fascinating new information on humpback whale communication, showing that we can tell where a whale has traveled from the themes in its song. Sometimes when you travel, you still betray where you came from when you open your mouth. The same thing seems to apply to humpback whales. Features of their songs can reveal where they originally came from. What's more, when whales travel, their songs change as they pick up new tunes from whales they meet that have come from different regions.
Our best analogy is to human fashion and pop songs, says Ellen Garland at the University of St. Andrews in the UK. The sharing of whale songs is a kind of cultural transmission that can give clues about where a whale has traveled on its migration and where it started out. We can pinpoint a population a whale has likely come from by what they are singing, she says.
Back on dry land, our good friend Meg Amos and her daughter Emily just returned from a great backpacking trip in the Seven Lakes Basin of the Olympic National Park and reported seeing 24 black bears in 5 days of hiking. They weren't at all bothered by the bears because the bears were so busy gorging themselves on the abundant and perfectly ripe native blueberries to notice any passing hikers. They also got some great photos of a bear wallowing in the warm waters of a shallow pond. It sounds pretty close to paradise for both bears and humans, feasting on blueberries and then taking a break to soak in a warm pool. They also had a very interesting encounter with a sooty grouse, which they saw eating a small frog. Who knew that grouse ever ate frogs? There are some great upcoming natural history events to tell you about this week.
The Olympic Peninsula chapter of the Audubon Society has a couple of fine events planned. The first, their monthly meeting, featuring a presentation on the wildlife of Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve. Join them at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, September 18th at the Dungeness River Audubon Center just outside of Squim. Then on Saturday, September 21st, there is a fall birding field trip for beginners and newcomers to our area. Meet at the Dungeness Audubon Center at 8:30. Walk will be along the Olympic Discovery Trail and should end at noon. Both events are free. Go to the OlympicPeninsulaAudubon.org for more details.
There are lots of events planned for next Saturday, so you will have to make some difficult choices. But the good news is that you can't go wrong. The Port Townsend chapter of the Audubon Society, Admiralty Audubon, also has a great field trip planned to Fort Casey and Crockett Lagoon over on Whidbey Island next Saturday morning. Plan to meet them for the 8 a.m. ferry from Port Townsend over to Whidbey, and go to admiraltyaudubon.org for more details and to RSVP.
If you listened to Nan's alarming show a couple of weeks ago on plastics in the ocean, you will be especially keen to join the Port Townsend Marine Science Center for International Coastal Cleanup Day next Saturday, September 21st. Meet at the PTMSC's Museum Portico at noon to be directed to where they need to most help, and go to ptmsc.org for more information.
Lastly, please join in a celebration of 30 very successful years for our local Jefferson Land Trust. Come to the old alcohol plant on Thursday, September 26th, from 6 to 8 p.m. for cake and light refreshments. The event is free and all are welcome. Please go to saveland.org for details. And here's our mystery sound again. Today we are very pleased to have Lucas Hart as our guest on Nature Now. He is director of the Northwest Straits Commission, which has an office right here at the Northwest Maritime Center in downtown Port Townsend. Welcome, Lucas.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. And perhaps you would start with describing what your mission is at the commission?
Yeah, sure. The Northwest Straits Commission is primarily there to help local communities get engaged in Puget Sound restoration and protection. That's our primary mission.
Then to the question that you're probably asked most often, what is the difference between the Northwest Straits Commission and the Northwest Straits Foundation? And then there's the Jefferson County Marine Resources Committee.
Yeah.
Further complicates everything. So how exactly does it all fit together?
Yeah, you're right. It is on the face of it, a pretty complicated organization. And I'll actually add another term in there, the Northwest Straits Initiative. The reason I do that is because I think I can describe it a little bit more easily by starting there. That's the umbrella term that encompasses the Northwest Straits Commission, the Northwest Straits Foundation, and seven Marine Resources Committees. So we're all housed under the Northwest Straits Initiative.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. And the Northwest Straits Commission, we're considered sort of the quasi-governmental arm of the organization. The Northwest Straits Foundation is the nonprofit arm. And the Marine Resources Committees are county-based volunteer groups that carry out restoration and protection projects. The commission was founded in 1998, and the foundation came on board in 2002. The reason the foundation was founded was to help supplement some of the funding sources that go to Marine Resources Committees to do their projects. And they can do that through philanthropic means because they're a nonprofit, a 501c3. The Northwest Straits Commission, we get most of our funding from state and federal sources. And that money also goes to Marine Resources Committees to do their projects.
Uh-huh. It's actually orchestrated with several different counties then.
Correct.
That's complicated.
Yeah, there's seven Marine Resources Committees in the seven northern counties of Puget Sound. So Jefferson County, Clallam, Snohomish, Island, Skagit, Whatcom, and San Juan all have Marine Resources Committees.
Ah. So I know that your organization is involved with a lot of different projects, but I'm especially interested in forage fish right now. So mm-hmm. I thought we'd start with that. What exactly do we mean when we talk about forage fish?
Forage fish are generally smaller fish. They're called forage fish because other larger species forage on them or eat them. And primarily in this region, when we talk about forage fish, we're talking about Pacific herring, Pacific sandlance and surf smelt. There are others as well, like northern anchovy and stickleback, but they're not quite as abundant as those other species.
Uh-huh. It's easy for people to get up in arms about the plight of charismatic megafauna like our resident orca, but what a lot of people don't realize is that their decline is tied into what happens so much earlier in the food chain, like what happens with the small fish and what happens with the eelgrass and the kelp. So I would like to address that issue. I mean, kind of get people to connect with forage fish and how important they are. What's the current situation with our forage fish populations?
Well, yeah, I will say you hit on something very important. I think we have some very charismatic megafauna here, like orcas, and I guess even salmon might fall into that category. And forage fish fill a really important niche in the food web that support those larger organisms. And we can even go down below forage fish and talk about plankton, which forage fish feed upon, or even algal species and marine vegetation that help provide habitat for many of these different species. Forage fish in particular, there have been some drastic declines in many of these species throughout Puget Sound. One of the populations of herring that's been watched for quite some time is a Cherry Point population up in northern Puget Sound. But generally speaking, if you lump all forage fish together, we've seen a decline over the last 100 years, and a pretty drastic decline. And in many cases, it's found off of more urbanized areas. And I think we are lucky here in the sense that we still have a chance to protect habitat that's important to these species and keep them around for a long period of time. Whereas in other areas of the world, habitat destruction has happened to an extent where it's no longer really possible to recover these species. So in some sense, we're lucky, despite the fact that we're seeing some pretty drastic declines.
Uh-huh. The other thing that you were telling me when we were having a phone conversation earlier, that there's not the amount of baseline information out there that we would like to have because there's not a commercial fishing industry for forage fish in this area. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah, the commercial fishing here is very small compared to other regions. And earlier in this century, in late 19th century, there was a pretty big herring fishery. And we saw during that time really, really drastic declines in the population due to that fishery. And it's never really bounced back since. So there are some small fisheries here that provide forage fish for bait, for things like halibut fishing and things like that. But because that fishery is largely non-existent, we don't really have the funding to study it, to study forage fish populations.
That's the irony, isn't it? Because there's not a commercial fishing industry. There's not funding to study something that is potentially in decline and clearly in decline in some areas.
Yeah, that it is pretty ironic. We could say, I guess, if there's an economy built around the fishery, there's usually more funding to try to understand it and to keep it around. Unfortunately, when that fishery was abundant here or was strong in Puget Sound, we didn't really know much about tracking forage fish populations, and there weren't really agencies that were studying it. I think it wasn't until probably 1915, 1916 when the first legislation was passed to really pay attention to the kind of impacts we're having on forage fish from fisheries.
Uh-huh. Well, another interesting thing to think about is that Chinook salmon and their decline is now, you know, there are red flags all over, but having a strong forage fish population is really good for, not only do the Chinook eat the forage fish, but they also keep other birds and marine mammals from eating the juvenile Chinook salmon.
Correct. Yeah. It's a pretty amazing system out there. you need forage fish around for many, many different reasons. You touched upon some of the most important ones there. I mean, right now we're seeing a lot of attention, and I guess for the last few decades, we've seen a lot of attention on salmon because they're so important for orcas and for cultural reasons in this region. And forage fish play an extremely important role in keeping those species here. And I think to some degree, we're getting more attention on forage fish now because of the decline and our lack of progress in recovering salmon. And now we're seeing, of course, southern resident orcas in a pretty desperate situation as well. So I think and I hope that we'll continue to get more attention put on forage fish. It's something I think we really need in this area.
Yeah, people don't pay attention to them because they can hardly see them.
Yeah.
But they don't realize that they're really one of the main building blocks for everything else.
Yeah, yep, that's definitely true.
So what do most forage fish in our area need for spawning habitat?
Well, it depends on the species, but again, speaking generally, forage fish spawn actually on beaches, which is pretty interesting, especially sand lance and surf smelt. So we need healthy beaches. And we also need healthy marine vegetation.
And those eggs are so tiny that people don't realize that they're walking over these eggs because they look just like grains of sand unless you see them under the microscope, right?
Yeah, yeah. Until you know what you're looking for, it's very hard to identify forage fish eggs on the beach. In some cases, they spawn in such a density that the eggs almost blanket the beach. That's relatively rare, though, and if you know what you're looking for, you can pick up a handful of sand and look at that sand closely and see the eggs. But you have to have kind of a trained eye to be able to do that.
So do they come up like at night and deposit the eggs on the beach?
It depends on tides, and yeah, and the cycles of forage fish spawning aren't really known that well, or at least I don't have it in my head in terms of when they come up on the beach, whether it's at night or during the day. I think it depends on the area and the tides, as I mentioned. But yeah, they do spawn on the sand. So when the tide comes in and forage fish spawn on the beach, the tide then goes out and those eggs are exposed to the environment. So they're not even underwater anymore.
Oh.
And that's one of the reasons why things like shoreline vegetation are really important, because that helps shade the beach and maintain optimal temperatures for egg development. So when we do things like shoreline development and we remove that vegetation, we're having a direct impact on forage fish spawning habitat.
Uh-huh. And then herring need eelgrass and kelp mm-hmm. and other substrates, right? They deposit their eggs in a different habitat altogether.
Yeah, that's right. Yep, kelp and eelgrass are two very important species for, I guess there's many species of each of those, but speaking in general terms again, herring do need vegetation for spawning.
What's the Northwest Straits Commission doing to help assess the health of our fish populations and protect these important species?
It goes back pretty far, actually. In the late 1990s, our San Juan Marine Resources Committee recognized the importance for halibut and other bottom fish. And they became very interested in forage fish at that time. And the commission worked with them and the Department of Fish and Wildlife actually to create one of the first forage fish spawn monitoring protocols. And that sparked a lot of forage fish monitoring throughout Puget Sound and led to about 100 miles of new sand lance and surf smelt spawning habitat designations. So it started at that time. It kind of ebbed and flowed between now and those initial monitoring efforts. And right now, well, about 4 years ago, we started another project with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, something we call our Index Site Monitoring Project, where Marine Resources Committees have index sites in their local communities that they go out to every month to collect samples and look for forage fish eggs. And the reason this is important is because agencies generally don't have the staffing or the funding to be able to go out to every beach every month. And when that happens, you don't get a very clear picture of the annual cycles of forage fish spawning. So by going out on a monthly basis, we can get a better idea of the spawn timing of forage fish, which will then allow us to better protect their habitats. And that's a volunteer project. We've had a great partnership with Department of Fish and Wildlife to develop that work. We also have work going on through the Northwest Straits Foundation that's related to restoration. And when we do restoration projects, something people may not realize is that you have to do pre-monitoring and post-monitoring to really understand what the ecosystem was like before and after the restoration work. So, for example, if there's a bulkhead somewhere, a concrete bulkhead, and we want to remove it, you look for forage fish spawning for about 5 years before that time, before the restoration project. And
it's so long term. I mean, you mm-hmm. have to have in your head what the projects are going to be and then get the funding for them. I mean, it's really complicated when you're looking at that many years invested.
You're right. Yeah. And it's another really important point. For a lot of these systems, you do have to look for tens of years or decades before you can really understand what the trends are, which is why long-term funding is so important. And I think that's one of the niches that the Northwest Straits Initiative fills is we can do this work very cost effectively because we have volunteers who are really interested and want to help. And, you know, they're doing this work for free. And I think it's important from that perspective. And it's also important from the perspective that local communities can get directly engaged in this work and people listening can get involved with their marine resources committees as volunteers or maybe even as a member of the committee to help prioritize these projects and get on the ground and involved.
Yeah, well, we will get that information out there to our radio audience so that they can contact you and get plugged into some of this great work.
Sure.
And as I suspected, we've run out of time. We've mm-hmm. only covered forage fish and we've run out of time for today. But the good news is that Lucas is going to be back with us to do a part two to cover all the other cool projects and give you that contact information for how to reach him and how to volunteer with them. All right. Thanks so much, Lucas.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Bye-bye. It is the sound of herring farts. I know. I was so very pleased when I found this sound. You can't imagine. The fact that some fish make noise has been known for a while, and they have recently been the study of marine biologists up in neighboring British Columbia. Of the 400 species of fish in BC's waters, 22 are known to make sounds, but there are probably a lot more we don't know about. Fish tend to talk in one of two ways. Some use their bones. Catfish make sounds by moving the vertebrae in their spine, while seahorses knock the bones in their skull together. Others, such as rockfish, quickly contract specialized sonic muscles around their swim bladder to make low-frequency grunting noises. In primitive fish such as herring, the swim bladder is connected to the digestive system, so a sort of buzzing noise is produced when air is forced out the anus. Lauren Still at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia, and his colleagues won the Ig Nobel Prize in 2004 for discovering these, quote, fast repetitive ticks, unquote, or FRTs, or farts. Herring tend to use farts most often at night and when they are in large groups. Dill suggests that they use the farts to communicate and keep their school together in the dark. Many thanks to Hakai Magazine for this fascinating information and for the links to the sounds of herring flatulence. And that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the second week of September. Thanks very much to our sound engineer, Nora Petrich, for her usual fine editing and for helping me share upcoming observations and events. And thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you've missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 12:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. Closing music is The Shoals of Herring, sung by Oscar Isaac. As always, happy trails.
Oh, it was a fine and a pleasant day. Out of Yarmouth Harbor I was faring as a cabin boy on a sailing lugger for to hunt the bonny shoals of herring. Now you're up on deck, you're a fisherman. You can swear and show a manly bearing. Take your turn and watch with the other fellas as you hunt the bonny shoals of herring. Well, I earned my keep and I paid my way, and I earned the gear that I was wearing. I sailed a million miles, caught 10 million fishes. We were dreaming.